meeting is now being recorded.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all, and welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures Working Group Subteam Track 2 Legal Regulatory Call on the 24th of August. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken via the Adobe Connect room. So if you happen to be only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now? Thank you. And as a reminder to everyone, please state your name before speaking, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will turn the meeting back over to Michael Fleming.
Thank you, Michelle. Sorry about that. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this week. This will be the last meeting that we have here in August. And we will be jumping into a new schedule in September where we will be having weekly meetings due to the amount of material that we have to cover. First of all, I would like to ask if anyone has an SOI update, a statement of interest update, and if they would like to share that with us. Hearing none and seeing nothing in the chat, I'm just going to go ahead and move on towards the discussion today. Today we will be discussing the registrant protections as a part of the review of the CC2 responses, and then after that we hope to move on to closed generics, probably not in the next meeting, but the one following that. I am currently scheduling that we will be taking about two meetings per topic at the current time. If we can finish sooner than that, then all the merrier. Could we have, could I have control of the slides, perhaps, please? Thank you. Is this unsynced for everyone, or am I controlling how everybody views the slides?
You are controlling it for us.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. So just a quick view of the agenda. As you see, we are on the CC2 common. Well, the discussion recap, same thing. Our goal of this discussion is, as always, to move towards deliberations and proposals for steps forward for the initial report. Our schedule today's meeting is the 24th of August, where we are discussing registrant protections, and the 7th of September, we will be looking at registrant protections and also breaking into proposed generics if we have time. Somebody else seems to have... Okay, moving on. So where are we at right now with registrant protections? So we've discussed registrant protections in regards to the continued operations instrument, the emergency backend registry operator process, as well as background screening process. So as for the COI, our discussions left us at some very good places. There are basically, we seem to have a good consensus that there were many complications and limitations identified with the COI in order to operate as a funding mechanism for the EVRO, and we seem to be in agreement that alternative methods of funding, we currently have had alternative methods proposed. We're not necessarily in agreement with which one to go with, but that's what we're discussing today for. In regards to the EBRO, we discussed and analyzed the data about the incurrences of EBRO, yet there has been little support for making any changes to EBRO at this time. I would just like to mention that we have had some significant data provided back from ICANN in regards to whether or not the EBRO process has occurred up until now. If I remember correctly, right off the top of my head, I believe the EBRO that it was 27 occurrences of a registry operator going over the emergency threshold, and ICANN decided to work with the registry operator in order to resolve the issue instead of initiating Ivro. And as far as the background screening process is concerned, there was the discussion on having different requirements for the background screening based upon the type of TLD. For example, if there could be different requirements for closed and open TLDs. We haven't reached a conclusion on this. However, this is the point of discussion for today as well. I know that we did discuss requesting data from ICAM in regards to this. I do not think that we did that. Steve, I think your answer the other day was that we have not reached that point in asking ICANN for data in regards to the background screening process. However, there was a report that we could reference, and I can't remember the name of the report right off the top of my head, but we can reference that if we need to look at further data. But I think we'll be looking at background screening process questions and answers probably next week if we're lucky. Oh, sorry, no, if I'm correct in our scheduling and how long it will take to go through today. But if not, Steve has kindly put it in the chat for us to look at. So then, let's go ahead and jump into the questions right here. So the CC2 questions for Section 3, sorry, WorkRack 2, Section 3, left us with 3 or 4 questions, I believe. Just to jump through the first question, 2.3.1, ICANN has included the following programs to protect registrants: an emergency back-in registry operator, EVRO, continued operations instrument, CUI, data escrow requirements, and registry performance specifications in Specification 10 of the Basic Registry Agreement. Don't know why there's a question mark there. Such programs are required regardless of the type of TLD. Are there any types of registries that should be exempt from such programs? If so, why? Do the above programs still serve their intended purposes? What changes, if any, might be needed to these programs if an RSP pre-approval program discussed in Section 1.1.1 were to be developed? So we'll be working in kind of correlation with WorkTrack 1 on this. Still, I think we'll be able to separate the material. So, as for the responses, I've split this up depending on the type of answers that were provided, and this was kind of organized in the themes document similarly by staff. But that's why we have some long slides and some short material slides. But I think for the purpose of organization, this is clear. So, first of all, the ALAC and affiliates supported maintaining current protections. ALAC merely said that current protections should remain, as well as affiliates saying that insofar as the EBRO is able to support the largest TLDs by registration and usage, WHOIS, DNS, SRS interactions, the EBRO model should be sufficient as defined. And yes, Emily has provided the full comments and then the link. Just as a disclosure, we are not only considering the material in just the slides, we're considering its full, its entirety. However, for the purposes of efficiency in getting through material, we have taken the liberty of going through a few of those comments. Pulling out the necessities of those comments and putting them on here. If anyone feels that their comments should be read out in a different manner or in its entirety, please do let us know. And if anyone has a question or has a comment, please feel free to raise your hand at any point in time. I will kindly stop and give you the floor. If not, though, I'm going to just to cruise through these questions so we can get through as much as possible. So Jim Prendergast recommended re-examining the entire EBRO concept. The entire EBRO concept needs to be re-examined. It is an ICANN-created artificial safety net that ensures no registry ever fails. but it's not how markets work. ICANN is supposed to be ensuring competition in the registry space. By not allowing registries to fail, they are preventing full competition from happening. Thank you, Jim. If you feel that you'd like to expand on that, please do feel free. If not, though, I'm going to keep moving on. So in our next comment, John Poole stated that registry protections should be expanded and no registries should be exempt. The excerpt. First of all, in regards to the question, are there any types of registries that should be exempt from such programs? No. What changes, if any, might need to be needed to these programs if an RSP pre-approval program discussed in Section 1.1.1 were to be developed? Registrant protections are pathetic, need to be greatly expanded. This is one of the big failings of ICANN in the 2012 round. Thank you, John. If you have more in-depth answers as to what we need to expand on, that would be very much appreciated. So our next slide stops. Our next slide starts with comments from Denny's, Nominate, BRG, Validatus, and RYSG, recommending to adjust registry protections to provide exemptions to closed TLDs. So Demis has made the comment that brand TLDs should be exempt from the requirements for an EBO, COI, or data escrow. The true purpose of all these measures is to protect an end user of a domain, in the case of the registry business failing to operate. When the only end user is the registry operator, as well, these measures do not protect it. Nominate has provided us with the comment. Registrant protection is a proper objective, but these programs appear to have been drawn up on the basis of all Ninja TLDs being an open registration model. It seems total overkill for a closed .brand new GTLD to have such fail-safe protections built in as mandatory. When there are no domain registrations, EBRO, COI, ESCO are all unnecessary and not appropriate in our view. I seem to have lost use of my mouse. Is everybody with me on the next page, slide 10? Can anybody hear me? Okay, I see people. Okay, thank you. Excuse me. So our next comment comes from BRG. It's Jeff has also put something into the chat. So this works in relation with our draft team for the different TLD types discussion as well. And that, while I believe that one is moving along swimmingly, this, if anyone would like to share with us their ideas for certain TLD types, or in fact, what kind of exemptions we should have, that would be great. Thank you. Okay. So, the BRG comment. The registration protection mechanisms were conceived on the basis of applicants replicating traditional models of selling and distributing domains to third parties. With the introduction of different models whereby the registry operator and its affiliates and team trademark licensees is the sole registrant, these safeguards are meaningless. In effect, they are having to safeguard themselves, which is an unnecessary and unreasonable burden which should not be required in the future. Thank you, Virgi. Validaeus has... just one brief moment. Let me have a drink of water, please. Thank you. So as indicated in the comment from Validaeus, as indicated, these provisions were intended to provide protection for third-party registrants. Where a brand TLD qualifies for Specification 13 or for registries which have been granted an exemption to the Specification 9 Code of Conduct, the classes of registrant are narrowly defined and limited to the registry operator or for Specification 13 registries. To affiliates and trademark licensees, in other words, to group companies and third parties who have a direct contractual relationship with the registry. Consequently, these registrant protection provisions seem excessive and unnecessary. It is possible, of course, that a Specification 13 registry operator might have a number of affiliates and trademark licensees, but this possibility does not necessitate all Specification 13 registries being subject to these obligations. Consideration can be given to a threshold of level of registrants after which the brand registry would be required to put these registrant protections in place. Validaeus. We have Susan's not here, and Jeff Newman too is here. I guess I have a question in regards to this comment. If I could take my co-chair hat off for a moment. Jeff, are you back with us? Okay. My question would be on the measuring the registrants for the brand registry. Would you measure that based upon different WHOIS information? Because I've seen a lot of brand TLDs that keep them as the similar, saying the same WHOIS information, even if the for example, the domain might be used by an affiliate. Just something to consider, but how that could be measured, if it were to be implemented on something like threshold.
Sorry, this is Jeff. So you're asking, if everyone's got the same WHOIS record, how would we know whether they have affiliates or trademark licensees using it?
Yes, in your non-co-chair hat.
Well, although I work at Validaeus, I specifically removed myself from the drafting of these comments, so I am seeing them just like you. So I did not draft these comments, but I would say that to the extent that, and just reading this, to the extent that they have trademark licensees and affiliates, I'm not sure that they would need a number of the protections. I think the same rationale still would apply for exemptions from certain registrant protections. So I'm not sure, even if we couldn't tell whether they're the entity itself or the trademark affiliates or licensees, I'm not sure that would create a difference. But if there was an exemption and it did matter, there would be other ways other than looking at WHOIS records that we could put in the agreements for enforcement purposes.
Thank you, Jeff. And sorry to put you on the spot. Thank you for your clarification on your position and when these comments were written. Thank you. And we've also had a comment from Alexander Schubert. If it's cheaper and easier to apply for a brand TLD, we'll apply for a generic term-based GTLDs as .brand. Play single registry, then distribute the domains in the same way. Like CentralNIC right now distributes third-level domains under two-letter.coms. We need to make sure that generic terms cannot be applied for as per TLD. Jeff, you have your hand up again. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, Alexander, this is a question just for Alexander. If you, as you know, there's really no such thing as a generic, as a term that's only a generic term that could not otherwise be used as a brand. So, for example, Apple is already a brand TLD. There are plenty of other examples. So I'm just not sure how you would go about measuring what is a generic term. And so I think that's something we would need to delve into if that were the opinion of the group. Thanks.
Yeah, this is Alexander. Can you hear me?
Okay, go ahead, Alexander.
Yeah, fine. So to answer your question, Jeff, well, that's obviously difficult because you would have to use a base, like, for example, the English and the Spanish and the German dictionary or something like that. And yes, there are a few brands who desperately want to use a generic term for a brand, and it's not forbidden, but sorry, there are problems if you use generic terms as a brand. And one problem might be that you don't get your brand TLD.
Thank you, Alexander. Greg, you have your hand ups. Please go ahead.
That's actually not at all how it works. First off, there are a huge number of trademarks that I probably say the vast majority that are not coined or fanciful made-up terms. Most of them are, in fact, terms that, you know, already exist in the language in some way, shape, or form. So, and trademark law gives those types of brands very robust protection. We can't go and try to parse between different types of brands, especially when it comes to actually setting up a dot brand type TLD, putting aside the gaming issue that Alexander seems to be concerned about. There's just no basis for distinguishing between arbitrary or suggestive uses of words as brands and fanciful words as brands. The point of a brand TLD is how it's operated in any case. If anything, the definition of what can actually be considered a Spec 13 brand TLD is too narrow. I have a client whose actual brand is the same as a CCTLD 3166, so they used a slight variation by throwing the word company in. They were not allowed to be a brand TLD, or at least a Spec 13 TLD because of that. So I think a brand trademarks are what they are. Brand TLDs are operated as what they are. And, trying to pretend that it's something different or that it's some so few there is just not correct as a matter of fact. And if new TLDs and the Internet are going to function, and if TLDs are going to be valuable, one of the great values will be in brands creating spaces. And there's no way – and cutting that off would be as would not be a wise move. Thank you.
Greg. Thank you. So we're getting a lot of comments in chat as well. Thank you, everyone, for your comments on this. I do have to say that I believe part of the discussion on the different TLD, and this is a little bit outside of the working track too specifically, but more so on the draft team, is also considering migration of TLD. Sorry, not migration of TLD. That's not a proper term. A transition from one TLD type to the next, whether or not that is possible. But there is a cutoff point, I believe. There's different things that apply, and if it's not within the term of the trademark, if it's not the TLD is not being used within the terms of the trademark, limitations, then they can't necessarily operate as a brand TLD. So I believe that we're taking that into consideration. So in regards to concerns about gaming, I believe those concerns can be addressed, as well as the making sure that brand TLDs stay within their remit of what they're being allowed to from the specification from contractual amendments like specification 13. Would anyone else like to chime in on this discussion at the current time? Chime in as in I mean raise your hand and speak for yourself. Hearing none, then let's continue that discussion in the drafting team so we can discuss the register protection specifically here. Thank you. Sorry, there was another comment by the RYSG in regards to this. Okay, hold on a second. Okay, sorry, slide 11 here. There's another comment from the RYSG in regards to the closed TLD discussion. Closed TLDs for which the registry is also the registrant should be exempt from EBRO and COI. The protection provided to registrants by EBRO is consistency. In the event a registry that goes out of business, the registrant will not lose their domain names. This is not necessary for closed and particularly brand TLD as the registrant is the registry. Similarly, a COI's intent is to fund the EBRO in the event it is needed. Where a registrant of a closed TLD goes out of business or decides to hold its registry business for any reason, the registry has necessarily already taken into account its own interests. Thank you. So, moving on to more responses in regards to 2.3.1. And I do believe that 2.3.1 is our longest replied question, so I know it feels like we've got a lot of comments, but look at this, I think we're already at least a good quarter of the way through. So, these next comments are in regards to the COI. So, Aphilius and RYSG suggested that in cases where the registry operator is different from the registry service provider, the registry operator is failing financially, but the technology is working fine. It should be possible for customers to remain with the existing RSP. Sorry, not necessarily the COI, but actually some transitioning discussions. So, these are the following are excerpts. First of all, from Aphilius, streamlining is possible when a registry operator is different from the registry service provider. To ensure stability, limit any service interruption and or remove transition burden to registrars. ICANN should provide the current RSP the opportunity to continue managing the TLD and become the registry operator. Example given, sign the base registry agreement for the specific TLDs. And then a comment from the RYSG, from the Registry Stakeholder Group. Sounds better when you say the full name. The EBRO concept makes sense and should be maintained if a registry operator serves a technical back-end function in addition to being the registry operator. Yes. In a case of a registry operator with a different technical back-end, however, it may not. Considering ICANN requirements, transitioning backends is a cumbersome process. In the case where the technology is working fine, but the registry operator is failing financially, it would make more sense to leave the customers on the existing backend instead of transitioning them to an EBRO and then again to a new registry operator and backend. Thank you. um, So this is this section is a bit special, and I believe that these are the only two comments in regards to having a if a registry operator does fail, but keeping with the current RSP. Would anyone like to comment in regards to this? I see Gigi. I see you typing. Okay, so that's the discussion. Oh, Alan, forgive me. You have your hand up, please go ahead.
Thank you. I don't have a comment, but I have a question, or at least something to pose. Is there any downside if we were to say this was the rule? Do we know of any downside?
That is
it's clearly a simpler process. We would obviously need certain conditions saying, you know, if that rule is already there, the registry operator cannot be a felon because registries cannot be owned by felons. But, you know, aside from a number of things, conditions like that, which might well have to be met anyway as a registry operator, I'm having a hard time figuring out why we wouldn't want to do it now that we've thought about it.
Alan, I think that the only, I don't think there's a problem with it in the general sense. I think the only request that I would have is that, as you suggested, is to make sure that if the RSP, for example, has not gone through the necessary evaluation procedures prior to the signing the agreement or at any point in time, for example, for another TLD, that they would at least go through that at some point before, and then signing the registry agreement. But other than that, I don't see an issue with that personally with my co-chair hat off, of course.
It's Alan again. I presume we already have a policy for if I own a registry, if I was granted the TLD and I now want to sell it to Joe, I presume we already have a process for vetting Joe. So it's a process we already know how to do.
Joe would be subject to a lot of different
evaluations. But right now we allow people to sell their registry, and therefore
yes, we do.
Therefore, we have a process in place, or should.
Yes. Thank you, Jeff. You have your hand up as well. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about the whole weird thing about the eBro concept is that eBro is designed around technical failures, not financial failures. Although when ICANN talks about it in public, they talk about this is to protect registrants if there is a financial failure. But all the triggers for eBro are actually technical. So, I mean, if you think about this question, it doesn't necessarily, what the registries say, they say that in a case where the technology is working fine, but the registry operator is failing financially, it would make more sense to leave customers on the existing back end. I agree if that were the case, but if that were the case, then eBro would have never been triggered in the first place because there is no financial failure trigger. The only triggers are DNS, SRS, who is, and escrow and DNSSEC. So those are the five triggers. So this whole thing never made sense to me, the whole eBro, and especially this comment, because again, eBro does not kick in if there's a financial failure. Maybe we should think of, instead of having this eBro concept that kicks in amongst technical failure, maybe there should be bankruptcy, financial failure, continuity program as opposed to this eBro.
I think, Jeff, that's a very good offer. Observation, and if it were not 6:30 in the morning, I might have recognized it myself. But I do believe that there's currently a provision within the agreement, actually, that talks about bankruptcy and the process for ICANN, how ICANN would take in regards to at least transitioning at that time, and the types of decisions that they would undergo such process. I think it's just a matter of perhaps looking at that and adapting something similar like this to that. But as you've said, that's a discussion that we can have a little bit later on. Let's go ahead and move on. We still have a lot to get through here. So our next discussion, excerpts come from Registered Stakeholder Group, the ALAC, and please forgive me if I pronounce this incorrectly, Janik Skell on the potential RSP program. So the Registered Stakeholder Group gives further comments in regards to, in the event where a pre-approval process is developed, whether or not the registry is a closed registry should be taken into account when making the decision to implement EBRO and COI requirements against that registry. The escrow requirements and the performance specifications in Specification 10 seem odd. Then our comment from ALAC is, on possible development of an RSP program, the ALAC does not see any benefits from the further expansion of new GTLDs into the main system. Benefits could be achieved by the proposed program to develop and enhance the technical and knowledge capacity of RSPs, especially for undeveloped economies. And then Janet Scow's comments are am against RSP pre-approval program. See your comments above. I'm assuming that those comments are in the 1.1.1 section of the RSP program. I think that we may relay these comments to Work Track 1 for input as well. So let's go ahead and move on. And we have reached Section 2.3.2. Now then, in the working group discussions, it became clear that the EBRO funding model requires review and potential modification. The current COI model is one that has proven to be difficult to implement for any registries, ICANN, and even financial institutions. Are there other mechanisms of funding EBRO providers other than through letters of credit and or other continuing operations instruments? If I sneeze while I'm reading the next few comments, please bless me. I'm sorry, please excuse me. Like I said, 6:30 in the morning. So this is a section I hope that we're able to engage a lot of feedback on, not just from what's in the comments, because this is a very touchy, or at least this is a concept that we need to have a very stern base in regards to. So the more discussion we have and the better solution that we can find, the better implementation can be done based upon our policy recommendations. So, our first comments discussed this suggested alternatives to the COI model. From Janik Skell, we have, generally, I see no need for the COI. Let the surplus cover or increase SLAs for all other TLDs if funds are needed. Consider charging $5,000 U.S. dollars in startup SLAs, and let ICANN use that money to pay EBRO providers. Then you only contribute half costs if delegated. The COI causes too many problems for non-U.S. applicants from U.S. bank clients, that is. Excuse me. The first comment was from the previous question that we had, but related probably more to this discussion. Our next comment is from Nominate. We suggest that ICANN does away with COI completely. The cost of maintaining a hot standby eRIBO, so probably eRIBO, could be met by ICANN charging a small surcharge on a per-domain basis for new GTLD registries, which require eRIBO services by virtue of operating an open registry for retail domain registries. Over time, a contingency fund for eRIBO could be built up by ICANN, perhaps seen by the surplus proceeds from round one. Yes, that's discussing the surplus from round one is a discussion that we do not have authority over, at least in saying what to do with those funds, I believe. And that triggered a few comments. But I'd rather not. I don't think that we should focus on that bit. I think that it is generally understood that all we have is the discussion, or at least merit on, we can make recommendations in regards to how future surplus may be handled, but not, at least at the current time, for how that surplus from the first round can be handled, from the 2012 round. Thank you for bearing with me. So our next comment comes from John Poole. Each bidder for a new GTLD would be required to deposit $1 million if the bidder was awarded rights to operate the new GTLD for a 10-year term. ICANN would hold its $1 million as a guarantee of performance, subject to charges for any breach or costs incurred by ICANN during the term of the RA. At the end of the term, the balance of the $1 million would be refunded or applied against the deposit required if the registry operator wanted to bid again to operate the GTLD. Thank you, John. And our next comments come from the Registry Stakeholder Group. I'm just checking the chat really quick to see if we are having a relative discussion in regards to, not to say that the current discussion is not relevant, but to say if it's related to what we're discussing at the current time. I'm not seeing comments immediately that relate immediately to what we're discussing now, so I'm just going to go ahead and continue reading. If you would like to chime in, please do raise your hand. I will stop after we read the registry stakeholder comment to see if we can get feedback in regards to these different alternative methods of funding. So from the registry stakeholder group, the COI, which is the eBro funding mechanism, is entirely inefficient, complicated, and overkill. Instead of insurance, where each party pays a certain amount to create a fund that would more than cover the percentage chance of failure, the COI requires each and every registry to fully fund the risk 100%. This is an excerpt from 2.3.1, but these answers related to this section specifically. We think that the COI model should be tossed out in favor of something more efficient and commonsensical. Alternatives to a COI would be a fund, which would be funded by application fees. Similarly, an eBro and COI should not be necessary if a third party back and agreed to maintain registrants on its platform for a certain period as a commercial matter. Perhaps a certificate from a back-end provider of this requirement would be sufficient to avoid the eBro requirement and its funding. So very quickly, this idea is third-party back-end agreed agreed to maintain registrants on its platform seems to be a bit different from the last discussion in regards to them succeeding the registry operator in a financial failure. But this is a different element. Just wanted to make that clear. And I will now open the floor to comments, noting if this is all we... Yes, okay. This is our last comment in regards to this specific category of responses. So how does everyone feel about the alternative, having some of the alternative methods that have been proposed? A fund that is collected from a fund that is started from as part of the application fees, the $1 million deposit, the contingency fund for eBrew, or having a surplus cover the funds, or the $5,000. Yes, perhaps from the Jernick sponsor seems to be the idea of a deposit that would be returned if you're not delegated. So, any responses? I will go ahead and check chat to see if anyone has provided input in regards to this. Jeff, you have your hand up. I was just going to read your comment, but please go ahead.
Yeah, so I think what we should do is we should document the different types of alternatives that have come up. I think we need some research done on the different alternatives. I remember when alternatives were discussed for the 2012 round, ICANN was afraid of setting up something that looked like insurance, because then it would be governed under certain laws and regulations if it looked like we were setting up sort of an insurance fund. That said, there are certainly other options other than this COI that were initially ruled out that could be addressed. But I think one of the things that is captured as an agenda item is we should figure out, look, how much has ICANN paid eBrew providers since this program has started in the aggregate? I do know that there is it's a two-pronged fee. It's an annual fee for each of the providers plus it's a small annual fee, if eBrew was ever had to be called up, then I think the eBrew gets some additional funds for the work it does on that. So we could probably get an aggregate of the total amount spent by ICANN over the years and then get an idea of the true cost and then figure out an appropriate funding mechanism. But I do agree with you. We can't go back to the funds from 2012 because that's not within our jurisdiction. But we could say that a fund should be set up for this purpose. And we think based on past, the amount of the fund could be whatever we think it should be. And we can suggest potential alternatives for, filling that fund.
Thank you, Jeff. So lots of ideas, lots of elements there. First of all, I think that's taking my, I don't know, keep my co-chair hair off. Yes, keeping my co-chair hat on and saying in regards to the suggested ideas for how we can kind of do more work on this, I think it's a great idea to look at the past research. I'm also hearing we should ask ICANN, we should check with ICANN in regards to some of perhaps how they might feel about some of these mechanisms, and then also looking at that, what other mechanisms were explored in the past, and perhaps what we could do in regards, instead of the COI, and then also looking at this, discussing a bit of the surplus aspect. I'm going to look at those, come back to this also when I'm in a bit more right state of mind. But does anyone else have some feedback or some input in regards to concerning Jeff's ideas or the suggested alternative methods within the that within the comments that we are reading right now? Hearing none, we are 7 minutes from the hour. I think I'm not gonna cut this early. But just move on. I just want to, please bear with me for a moment. I just want to see how many more comments we have in regards to sections and what our cutoff point today would be. Okay, so I'm gonna try to get to the next three slides. Or do we cut it off? I'm just thinking. Okay, no, let's just go with it. Okay. Excuse me. So the Registry Stakeholder Group provided additional guidance for ICANN if the COI requirements remains in the future. Actually, Phil, we're up to page 18. But thank you. Should ICANN choose to maintain a COI requirement, letters of credit are the simplest and most effective means of accomplishing the EVRO funding requirement. With that in mind, we encourage ICANN to be more understanding of business realities when calculating the size of letters of credit. We suggest a percentage level, a 10% change in estimated domains under management, not a 10% change in historic DOMs, but in estimated and LOC-funded DOMs. We also suggest an annual review. Similarly, the language requested by ICANN for LLCs was untenable for most banks. ICANN should consider more commercially reasonable language and ensure that it is provided to applicants in advance to avoid the issues registries experienced during the 2012 round in endeavoring to secure LLCs. For larger registries, especially portfolio registries, there must be a means of more easily incorporating additional TLDs into an LLC, and contrarize removing them in the event of sale. Does anyone have any comments in regards to this? So now this one is suggesting if we were to keep the current method as is and how we could better facilitate that. And none, I'll move on to the next few comments, which I think are related to this as well. So additional comments, and this is from 2.3.1 from our Registry Stakeholder Group. The COI, which is the EBRO funding mechanism, is entirely inefficient and complicated instead. I'm thinking that I might have made a mistake when making these slides. This seems to be a repeat from previous page. So, just checking here that this was in just the last page. So I'm going completely. Oh. Did we read these questions? Sorry, these comments? Oh, yes, we did. They're right here. Okay, so, yes, we did read these comments from the Registry Stakeholder Group already. Sorry about that. I made a mistake in creating the slides. So that will leave us off from question 2.3.3, which is a great place to start for our next call. All right. Does anyone have any other business or any last comments they wish to make? I've seen a lot of people typing in the chat. Yes, thank you for the link to the eBro providers. And Heather, I think you've been typing for a little bit now, but I'll give you a few seconds to go ahead. Okay, so you stopped typing. All right. With that, I am going to... Oh, sorry, you're still typing. So this, yes, this also includes the fees. If you go to the if you go to the Evero contracts and you go to the last page, I think there's an index of the different fees for what the is required in the letter of credit and how many UMs to cover. All right, then, if there is nothing else, I'm going to give everyone back 2 minutes of their life and hope you have a wonderful day. Thank you for joining us this week. We look forward to seeing you next month and discussing register protections, the background screening process. This is Michael Fleming saying thank you very much and have a pleasant weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michael. Again, the meeting has been adjourned. Have a great day, everyone.